Hi guys, this is Daniel Beals.
I'm Mila Yamamoto.
I'm Michelle Boyd.
We're from Geek Cred, and you are listening to We Be Geek.
We Be Geek.
To the Batmobile. Let's go. Atomic batteries to power.
Mission commencing.
My name is Optimus Prime.
All wings, check in.
Red 3 standing by.
Red 6 standing by.
Red 5 standing by.
Red Button standing by.
Red Fox standing by.
Big Red standing by.
Red October standing by.
Helen Reddy standing by.
Simply Red standing by.
So, the bad crowd you've been hanging out with is a science fiction club?
Meanwhile, back at the above-ground, underwater, suborbital volcano lair.
It is another episode of We Be Geeks. It's, what is it, Marty? Episode 60?
Sounds right. We'll go with that.
Wow. So you've been with me now 10 episodes.
Does that mean I've finally gotten my decoder ring or anything of the sorts like that? What do I get for 10 episodes? What'd you get me?
Just a nice, warm, fuzzy feeling.
And worst boss ever.
And a guest.
Oh, okay. That'll work.
Guest from a, I don't know what's the best way to put this, maybe the part of the Roger Corman of the Star Wars franchise. He was director of Star Wars Detours, which, 50 episodes made and then shelved?
Yeah,
39. Yeah. It's Todd Grimes.
Hello,
welcome to
everybody.
The show, Todd.
Thank you so very much for having me.
So we'll get to Star Tours a little later. We're warming up the interrogator droid in the back. So, how did you get started in the animation realm, which is what most of your career has been in?
Yeah, it's pretty much been my whole career. Well, first of all, thank you for having me. This is, it's an honor because these days I don't get a lot of these kind of requests, but it's great to be part of this show and, I love this show, so thanks for having me here. It's kind of a funny story. I was going to college for graphic design. And at the time I was working at the Disney store at the mall. And one of the ladies that worked at the Disney store, her husband happened to own an animation studio. And she asked me if I was interested in animation. And of course I said, yes, indeed I am. And the only reason I was, studying graphic design was because I thought that was the only way I could actually make a living. I thought there was no way I was going to be able to get a job. As, I wanted to be a comic book artist, I kind of had I like to draw and stuff like that. So I never really imagined myself in animation, but by happenstance, I managed to meet this woman who had a line into an animation studio. So I started interning at this animation studio, and this was in the days before Toy Story and things like that. So they were doing CG, they were doing computer graphics, but it was very, very early 90s, so it was kind of like really rudimentary kind of stuff. But I got in on that and started interning at that studio and then ultimately got a job there and did a lot of work in that field. But it was all advertising stuff. So, working at that job, I realized fairly quickly that I wanted to do more entertainment kind of stuff, like actual character animation and storytelling type animation. So I made the move to California, fortunately managed to, keep getting jobs despite the fact that I was, flying by the seat of my pants.
What was that first step like going from, because you said you were doing art and graphic design and stuff like that. Had you tinkered any in doing actual animation at all? Or was that like when you got the job and internship, was that the first that you really took that step from going from a static page to a moving page?
Yeah, there was, in working in graphic design, and especially at that time period in the early 90s, people were coming out with CG software, and I was working on a computer called the Amiga, which had a little video toaster set up, and then it had Lightwave in it, which was a piece of 3D software, and I would actually create little images in 3D to like little cups and stuff for advertising purposes, and put them into my design artwork. So I had some knowledge of sort of how to build things in CG, but I had no idea like what the capabilities of the tool was, you know. And it wasn't until I got into that professional environment that I realized really how powerful it was. Because at the time, for me, it was just another way to make pictures. But then once I could see how they were able to actually make them move and stuff like that, it was pretty fascinating, and it sort of opened up a whole new world to me. And even though I ultimately got a bachelor's degree in graphic design, I never worked a single day in the graphic design industry. I went straight into animation. But I feel as though that actual knowledge and that studying of that skill actually helped me quite a bit, because there's so much of design in every type of art, and even in animation, when it comes to just staging and composition and things like that, a lot of the conventions that you use are very similar to graphic design. So I feel like I felt like that was like, I'm glad that I did that, even though I never once used it. Like the guy that went to business school and then became like a violinist, you know? So
your first big break was Butt Ugly Martians?
I guess you can say that, yeah. I was an East Coaster. I was working in Connecticut, where I was born and raised. And I knew that the entertainment industry was out here in California. So my first job was out in California working at a video game company. And right when I got there, they had just landed the Butt Ugly Martians deal. And I remember getting there and started working on that television show right away. And it was kind of an interesting experience, because I don't think any of us really knew what we were doing, because we were all so new to the seat. Like at that time, that was sort of 1999, 2000, then there weren't a lot of CG television shows out there. So no one had really perfected the production process of that type of television yet. With the exception of maybe Foundation Imaging, who at the time was doing Starship Troopers and Max Steel, they were like really the forerunners. At that time anyway, so we got there and we were like, yeah, I think we can do this. And, you know, me at the time, I was about 24 years old when I got that job. And I distinctly remember being like the oldest guy at the studio. I was like the old man. So, and by de facto, I became like sort of a leadership role. I was just in retrospect, I was just a kid. At the time, I thought I was hot shit, but, you know. Oh, can I swear? Is that bad?
I actually try to keep it family friendly.
Well, can you bleep that part out?
Yes, I can. Yes, I can.
Looking back at it, yeah, there was myself and there was one other guy who was like a little bit older than me, and we were like the old men at the studio. And we produced that show and somehow figured out how to make it happen. But it was really like sort of the dawn of that era. And, you know, now everybody's doing it, but at that time it was a real challenge, you know.
I'm trying to grasp it, like 24, like having a show, pretty much put it in your hand and then like, okay, do it. And you actually really have no blueprint to go about it, you said, because, you know, there wasn't any other show to kind of steal from. So what was your thought process? Like how did you kind of figure out to get the ball rolling really and get these young whippersnappers in line?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think that like the studio that we were working with, at the time was a video game company in San Diego, and it was headed by sort of a guy that was kind of a really creative genius. This, you know, he was sort of like a creative madman, and he had all this visionary, his name was Matt McDonald, and he had all these visionary ideas about But Ugly Martians. I mean, he created the whole idea of it, and he was very prolific and really smart, but at the same time, he was sort of a loose cannon, and he owned the company, but his wife was the businesswoman, so to speak. Like, she ran the company. So he and I and the other artists were able to sort of have the freedom to explore, you know, how to make these things, how to produce these shows, you know, trying new software, you know, trying to see, like, what's the fastest way we can do it. But then we were working with producers and directors from Mike Young Productions. That was a studio up in L.A. that was actually sort of like the, you know, they were like the developers and the producers of the show. And they were very talented, too, and they were all very experienced in television animation. So they kind of guided us in the way of the production process, and then allowed us to sort of come up with the conceptual CG factor of, you know, how to make the show. And then, of course, we were also working with an overseas component. So we were working with a company in Hong Kong that, you know, was actually producing the actual animation and the lighting and everything for the show. So we had a lot of help from industry veterans at the time, you know, sort of.
What was it like working with the Hong Kong studios? I've heard some great stories of getting back, you know, the language barrier just kind of breaking down, or you know, just rushed animation, or did you have any stories that you can think of that of just like with the Hong Kong animation? I know, like, when they did Ren and Stimpy, I think I heard that there was just like some stuff that the guys would just leave in because to them it was hilarious, but they also didn't have time to change it either. So,
right,
you know, any times like that?
Yeah, I mean, that was my first. That show, if you know, talking about But Ugly Martians, that show was probably my first taste of working with a studio that's across the globe and an overseas component. And then looking back since then, you know, that's all I've ever done my whole career. I've become very, you know, at that point it was new to me. Now it's, you know, I've worked with dozens of overseas studios, and that's just kind of the way you do it. But at the time, I think we had a really good relationship with them, and we went out there to visit them and work with them in their studio. And like what you were describing, there is a little bit of a language barrier, and I never found that to be at all an issue, only in that once in a while, some of the comedy or the jokes don't necessarily, you know, they don't convey properly. You know, like, they get it, but sometimes they don't understand what, you know, and vice versa, you know, we don't understand necessarily their jokes either when they transfer to English, you know. So there was some stuff like that where we would have to kind of explain why the gag, you know, needed to be what it was. And then even after explaining it, you know, you kind of get the sense that they still weren't, they were kind of like, okay. And in their minds, they were like, you know, that's not really funny to us.
I'd love to sit on a conference call with, like, Seth MacFarlane to his animation studio, and like, especially in the early days when he's trying to do some of these Family Guy flashbacks, and like, try to get them to understand what it is. Because some of his are out there even for Americans, so.
Totally.
So, yeah, I'd love to see that conference call.
Yeah. I mean, I've sat in so many of those rooms, you know, because you know, you primarily work in that realm where you, if you're not physically there, it's always best to physically be there, but if you're not physically there, you're over video conference, and you're explaining to them, and you know, and the fact of the matter is like, you know, unlike our country, most people in other countries kind of all speak several languages. So a lot of them, you know, they do speak English, and they do get it, and they do kind of laugh at the jokes. But once in a while, you have to sort of say, oh, well, that's a reference to, you know, a Miley Cyrus thing, and they're, you know, that's not part of their mainstream, so they need the reference. And it's the same way back to us, you know, when you work with overseas studios and they've got a gag that they have an idea for that's based on something that's in more their mainstream media that we know nothing about. And then you're like, oh, okay, I didn't even know that was a thing. And then you, you know, you say, okay, that is pretty funny. I mean, no one here is going to get it, but I understand why that's funny. Yeah. So, it goes both ways, basically.
So how did you get involved with the Barnyard franchise?
That was, Barnyard. Well, I was working at various jobs in L.A., and one day I got a cold call from Steve Odekirk. He had just seen our website, myself and a couple of other artists that I was working with at the time. We were producing animation and doing like contract gigs and things like that, like little advertising demos and stuff like that. And Steve, you know, he saw it and he just out of the blue cold called my office line one day and just said, you know, I want to meet you. Let's talk about this project that I have coming up. And at the time that was the Barnyard, the feature film. And what we were doing at the time was I was working with a lot of really talented animators in CG, but what we were doing at the time was really trying to push the traditional animation principles, which is a lot of squash and stretch and things like that, and really try to, you know, like sort of get those methods into CG, which at the time was really difficult because, you know, again, this is, you know, 13 or 14 years ago where the tools didn't exist to really push the limits of hand-drawn animation in CG. But we were trying our hardest and we were cheating stuff left and right. but we were doing something that, like, caught his eye. He thought, like, I see what you guys are doing from an animation standpoint with CG. And he felt like, I want to make a CG feature film, and I would like you guys to implement your techniques into my movie. So myself and my business partner at the time, a guy named TJ Sullivan, we went up and met with Steve, or we went down and met with him because he was down in Orange County. And he basically just said, I want you guys to be animation supervisors on this feature film I'm doing. And of course we were like, well, we'll think about it. We walked out of the room going, well, yeah. it was a great experience because, you know, like I knew who Steve was because I was a fan of his work. You know, I'd seen the thumb stuff and I'd seen Kung Pao and stuff. I thought he was a really funny guy, you know. And I knew about his involvement through friends with things like Jimmy Neutron and working with DNA in Texas, the animation studio in Texas and stuff. I worked with a lot of those guys over the years. So to get a call from him at the time, I was thinking, wow, like this guy even knows my name. It was incredible. And then, so we spent almost 4 years working on that feature. Wow. And Steve was very, you know, he was very much to my benefit. He was very nice and sort of gave me the opportunity to, you know, sort of flourish a little bit and gave me the opportunity as a job as a director on the television show based on the feature film that we had spent, you know, 4 years making. So we started making the television show, which I was directing along with TJ Sullivan, who was, again, he was my partner at the time, and we had done the feature film, and we both started directing on the show and sort of, you know, ran the show from a directing standpoint along with producers there. And it was just a great experience. And like Barnyard, I spent about 7 years in total between the movie and the television show working on that property, and it really became sort of like a real big part of my life and my career at the time. And it was probably, you know, one of the most rewarding things that I had done, because it was so, you know, it was so much a part of, like, you know, our thumbprints were so much on that property that we really felt ownership of it. And that's kind of like what, you know, all artists strive to do when they make something, you know, so.
Yeah, it's kind of really unusual to be able to get, like, the guys that were behind the actual movie to do the production or the behind-the-scenes stuff for the TV show, too. Usually it's, like, handed off to somebody else, and then it's kind of, you know, most of the time it's sort of a rehash of different plot lines that were kind of in the movie to just kind of keep the movie fans happy. And so for you guys to go ahead and take it, have the characters, and, you know, maybe almost have a direction for them already to go, probably help the show flourish and keep it around a little bit longer than just being like, you know, 10, 12 episodes, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to think so, yeah, for sure. I mean, in the beginning, that was a big thing because we had, when we started the television show, we had brought in, or Steve had brought in, a gaggle of writers and producers that weren't part of the film. The only people that were actually really part of the film production were myself and my other director, TJ, and then maybe some of the visual artists. We used the same character designers and production designers. Bill Schwab, who's done a ton of, you know, Bill Schwab is a fantastic designer, and he's done so much work, and, you know, he's done tons of designs for, like Wreck-It Ralph and Frozen and all, you know, he's done a lot of work for Disney and Klasky Chupo and stuff like that. We were able to retain him to design the show, and a guy named Phil Cruden, who was the production designer on the film, stuck with us as well and was able to design all the production elements of the show. So I think that team between myself, and TJ, the other director, our production designer and our character designer, we really were able to maintain the basic look of the film and transport that into the television show. And then most of the voice talent was the same. The only change we made was in the film was Kevin James played the main character. Because of his schedule and whatnot, he couldn't do the television show. So we were able to get Chris Hardwick, who was extraordinarily talented and really, you know, pushed the character even further than, you know, we ever could have imagined. And, you know, he's just a really funny and talented guy. So, you know, we're really fortunate to get him.
Speaking of Hardwick, maybe you can answer the burning question some people always seem to have. Why does Otis have udders?
I know everybody asks that. People have been asking me that for, you know, the better part of more than a decade now.
It's one of those things that you don't think about it when you're watching it, but then you realize, oh yeah, this is a boy cow. Boy cows don't have udders. And then it's kind of like, you don't realize it until somebody points it out, and then it's stuck with you every time you see it. So do you have an answer as to why that is?
I have so many answers, and I have some great stories. But it was basically like, I don't know, if you've ever seen Kung Pao, Steve's movie that he made where he, Steve Odekirk, the movie he made where he sort of repurposed old kung fu footage and, you know, put himself in it. But there's like an epic battle between him and a cow. And Steve is just really, he thought cows are really funny. and one of the guys that, is credited as one of the designers, he sculpted a 6 foot cow, and the cow, it's a 6 foot cow. Imagine if you will, like a 6 foot statue of a cow, and his hand is out sort of like in the pose of like holding up something, and there, you can put a beer bottle in it, in the hand or whatever. So Steve bought the sculpture. It was at an art show, and he loved the way the sculpture looked. And if you've ever seen the sculpture, it looks exactly like what Otis looks like. When Steve originally started developing the property, he went to DNA who at the time was producing Jimmy Neutron, and those guys developed a look for the character based off this sculpture, which ultimately became, you know, was pushed a little further, more made more animation friendly for what you see in the film and the television show. But it looks just like the sculpture, which Steve still has in his office. Wow. And he just thought it was so funny looking. And in his mind, you know, Steve always said, you know, Barnyard is not a reality. It's just a universe. And in this universe, male cows have udders because I think they're funny. And it was, I got to tell you, it was pretty funny because there was a time where the movie was probably, I want to say, the feature film, we were about three quarters of the way done with it. And the studio had very big problems with the udders on the cow. And there were so many shots where, like, the udders were wagging in the camera's face. It was just terrible. And we had a meeting where it was myself and Steve, the director, and the production designer, Phil Cruden, and my other animation supervisor, TJ Sullivan, and a few other people. And we all sat in the room and had a heart-to-heart as to whether or not we were going to stick to Steve's guns and keep the udders on this on these cows or remove them entirely to make the studio happy. And it's funny because I'm almost ashamed to say it, but I was the only guy in the room that said, I think we should take the udders off. Everyone else in the room disagreed with me. Wow. And I mean, I didn't make that much of a point of it, but I was the only guy that was like, I don't think we need the udders. And boy, was I wrong, because, you know, everybody else, including like my other soup, TJ, you know, who I've been working with for years, he was like, no, the udders are funny, man.
I always wondered if that was like their way of being able to show boobs that aren't real boobs, like it's like that inside joke of, you know, hey, it's a cartoon and it's got boobs in it, you know. But
no, totally, it was. I mean, it wasn't. I don't think that was the intent, but it was. It's funny to see a guy dance around with basically, you know, boobs on his belly. And then the funny thing was is that the compromise we came to, and I wish I had footage to show you guys, because for the first couple of years of the film, the udders were about, like, you know, 5 or 6 inches long. And they were just dangling and really floppy. So after we had that meeting, what came out of it was that I was saying we should take them out. And everybody else, including Steve, was, like, saying, hell no, we're not taking them out. So the compromise we came to is that we shrank them down to just being, like, little nubbins. and then went back and reanimated a lot of the scenes where they were particularly, let's say, offensive, I guess. Like, there was a little too much utter action. And maybe that was my motive at the time. I don't know. Maybe I just did not want to go back into like, 400 feet of animation film and reanimate udders, but
right.
But we did. We shrank them down, and we made them, instead of flopping, like, you know, just like tails, we made them just more like rubber chicken, you know, like just kind of like jiggly a little bit. And then that seemed to appease people, except for there was one shot where Otis runs right to the camera and the udders are like flopping all the way right into the camera. And we had to go back and to that shot, I think, a few times and really tone it down and just make it, you know, sort of just like it, at least weird as we could possibly make it.
It's also nice to actually know somebody that has actually watched and enjoyed Kung Pao, because that's like one of those underrated movies that always kind of slips under the radar of people.
Oh, my gosh. It's so hysterical.
And it's one of those guilty pleasures.
Yeah. You've been talking about making a sequel for so long, and I keep telling him, I'm like, if you make a sequel, I want to be your sidekick. I mean, like, he wants to do something.
For some reason, I always love the line where it's during the voiceover part, but he's talking about his Betty, and so I'll throw in a random Betty at people, and I only have like one friend that knows exactly what I'm talking about, so, and I forget that most of the time, so I'll do it. and then people just look at me and just like, what are you talking about? Yeah. But yeah, that's my favorite go-to line from Kung Pao.
Right. So far, you can't throw those weird references out there in mixed company.
Right. There's, no, what? I don't know. There's nobody named Betty here. Just go away.
So far in 10 episodes, we've been Betty free. I see that.
Because I didn't know if you knew the joke. See, yeah, I can't throw it out anymore.
That's right. If you ever go back and watch the, if you get the DVD of Kung Pao, there are a couple of options for commentary. And one is sort of a more straightforward commentary where it's just Steve and his producer, Paul Marshall, talking about the film. And then there's the quote-unquote sort of, I forget what it's called exactly, but there's the crazy commentary. It's kind of like an Easter egg on the DVD. And it's just Steve the whole time over the movie just making weird noises and just going like, bleh, 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 like... But somehow it's like the funniest thing you'll ever listen to. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's so amazing. But that's the type of guy he is. He's just really just loves to just be like, I don't care. If this makes me laugh, I'm going to do it. And it's, you know, it's really funny stuff.
That's why I think sometimes like him in the match with like Jim Carrey for like Ace Ventura and stuff like that, it was almost like too perfect of a match. And that's why that movie stands the test of time. Cause I think you get a little bit of Steve and a little bit of Jim, and the combination of the two is just this really out there crazy guy.
Right. Yeah, totally. Because they developed that character because Steve was a writer on Mad TV when Jim was on Mad TV, and they developed that character during that time. And when you watch the second film, the second Ace Ventura film, you know, having worked with Steve, when I go back and watch that film again, I could totally see the points at which I'm like, oh, that is a total Steve-O moment. You know, I know... Like that, like when he comes out of that rhino, you know, and he's like, the rhino's giving birth or whatever. And it's like, and it's Jim Carrey just naked flopping out of a big rhinoceros. I mean, it's just genius. It really is. And it's like, it's the type of stuff that like really, really, you know, it just, you know, like who could have thought of that? And it just makes me really look back on that time as very fondly, thinking like I was really lucky to be able to work with those guys.
So. Now, looking at part of your bio, you went on after back at the barnyard to Planet Sheen.
Yeah.
But there a short time, is that because of detours coming along? Did they, did Seth pull you away?
A little bit. What happened was is that the guy that was originally running the show, the original supervising director for Planet Sheen, he left, and they needed another person, and it was sort of a little bit of serendipitousness because Barnyard got canceled, and that was sort of a crushing blow to all of us at the time. We were all very, you know, just. We had this thing that we thought was going to go forever, and we were winning Emmys and stuff for it and everything. It got canceled. I don't know if we were shocked, but we were kind of surprised. But at the same time, Planet Sheen was in its early stages. And, you know, just coincidentally, right about the time that Barnyard got canceled, the director for Planet Sheen left. And they asked me if I'd like to take over, and having no other job at the time, I said, absolutely, because it was going to be produced at the same studio that I was already working at. And I really liked Planet Sheen. I thought it was actually really brilliant. And I knew that I was a fan of Jimmy Neutron, because it was just, Jimmy Neutron was a wild success. You know, about 5 or 6 years earlier.
Right.
And I knew Jeff Garcia, who played Sheen, and all the other actors that we had been working with that worked on the show, like Rob Paulsen, and Fred Tatasciore, and all these guys that I had known for a long time. And I thought, you know, these guys are really great. The concept of the show was really fun. So I started working on the show, but at the same time, it was a situation where you know, just to give you a little backstory, is that I was originally contacted about the Star Wars Detour show while I was still on Barnyard. And at the time I told, you know, the person that was reaching out to me, I, you know, that sounds great and all, and I'm a huge Star Wars fan, but there's, you know, wild horses couldn't pull me away from Barnyard because that was my baby, you know?
Right.
But then, and Detours was in development for so long that they were still in the early stages, so it was slow going. And then by the time they called me again, I was working on Planet Sheen. And as much as I was proud of that show, and I also felt it was a really great piece of work to be involved in, it wasn't Barnyard to me. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't my, you know, I was stepping in for another guy. I wasn't there from the beginning like I was with Barnyard. It didn't have a special place in my heart the same way Barnyard did. So when the Star Wars thing came up, the Detours thing, I was a little bit, you know, less, you know, it was a more difficult decision to make at that point. Because, you know, if I got offered the Detours job while I was still doing Barnyard, I would have turned it down, basically. As crazy as that sounds. Because I was really devoted to Barnyard and Oedekerk, and all the crew that we had there. So it was sort of like it just sort of fell into place at the right time, at the right moment, you know?
Who approached you first on Detours? Was that?
I had a friend who was working on Clone Wars up at Big Rock, and she actually worked with me on the Barnyard feature film. And when they were looking for a director for Detours when it was in development, she called me originally, and I just told her I'm doing Barnyard, and there's no way in heck I'm going to move up to the Bay Area, you know, like at the time anyway, you know, now I'm here and I don't want to leave, but then, you know, as things go, development takes a long time. So it was several months later. But my colleague, her name's Julie Pang. She was one of the artists, one of the production crew that I worked with on the Barnyard feature. She was a production supervisor up at Clone Wars, and was trying to sort of, you know, finagle. She was basically trying to say, like, if you're looking for a director, this, you know, you should call my friend. And then eventually when it really became, when they were really hardcore looking for someone, was around the Planet Sheen time, and she, you know, called me again and gave my number to, Jennifer Hill, who was the producer on the Detour show, and they eventually called me. And then that was the point at which I was like, okay, I will at least consider this. And then, you know, the next thing I know, they were like, well, why don't you come meet George? And I was like, wait, George who? So I remember coming back and telling my wife, I'm like, I have to get this job.
That is some sneaky, sneaky stuff right there. Like, oh, why don't you come meet George? That, who's going to say no to George Lucas?
No, I know. It was pretty crazy.
Yeah.
But, I mean, at the time, I mean, they were interviewing other people, too. I mean, I was trying to think to myself, well, don't think about it too much. Don't put any eggs in that basket. Just look at it as like a nice thing, you know. But in the back of my mind, I was thinking like, I need to get this job. I need to have this job because it's comedy. It's Star Wars. It's everything I love in life. So
if you didn't get it, at least you got to go to the ranch.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It was pretty amazing.
Which is still on my bucket list.
Hey, you know what? If you ever make it out here, I'll take you over there, no problem.
Oh, there we go.
Cool. Very cool.
Do they give you like a cool little pass once you finally made the clearance list to be able to go when you need to?
Yeah, there's an actual free pass. No, I'm kidding.
The shape of a lightsaber.
Right.
It's like Disney. It's a main gate, and you get 3 guest passes.
Right. It's like, exactly. It's like an annual pass.
18 times a year. Well, I'm a Disney cast member. I work down here at Walt Disney World in Orlando as an audio engineer. Yeah, I'm primarily over at Epcot, so.
Yeah. Oh, cool. So wait, so you're in Florida?
Yes. And Marty's in Tennessee.
Yep.
Right on. Right on. Cool. Well, yeah, then you're part of the family.
Now.
That's
true.
That's true.
This is true.
I didn't even think about that. Does that still kind of surprise even like you, the whole like Disney buying it? Does that sunk in completely for you? Do you think it's gonna, you know, as a fan, do you think it's gonna do more, do less? What do you think about it?
I've had so much time to think about this because it was it's been like a year and a half, I think almost since that all went down. And I think, you know, I really think that it's a great thing for the Star Wars franchise, because I think, you know, and even talking to George about it, it was the notion that, you know, that Star Wars has always been, let's say, privately owned. I mean, it's George's property. It's not, for no pun intended, it's not really an empire. It's more like it's his little, pet project, even though it's the biggest pet project that has ever happened on Earth. But in order to preserve it and make sure that it will persevere, beyond George and beyond all of us, who else are you going to go to? You know, Disney is like a surefire win-win. It's just a great company. They're obviously their focus is on, producing, entertainment for the masses, you know, and that's what Star Wars is. It's for everyone. It should be for everyone. And that's, you know, there's a lot of other companies out there, a lot of other studios out there that, you know, that may not have the same, I don't know what you want to call it, the same leverage. Yeah. Yeah, or like the same vision, the same visionary goal. You know, Disney's not going to do anything that will, change the brand in any way. Because they are, in essence, one of the most family-friendly entertainment producers. And Star Wars, I'm speaking for George, but I think that, like, in his mind, that Star Wars has always been meant for all audiences. And that's a large part of what Disney does. So I think that, like, you know, where else are you gonna, what's a better fit than that to make sure that, number one, it stays what it's supposed to be, and number two, that it perseveres long after, the person who built the legacy is gone, and even the subsequent, you know, we're talking 100 years from now. Mickey Mouse has been around, you know, for almost 100 years. It's still as fresh as ever. You know, they put new shorts on the Disney Channel, and my kids love them. and we're talking about a character that's almost 100 years old. So I felt really good about that. Deal, because I knew that George wanted to retire, and I thought, like, what, you know, you want to leave it in good hands. So,
but in some way, I mean, I'm like you. I like to see that the franchise is getting some kind of like fresh, reinvigorating blood in it. But in some ways, that the changeover almost kind of screwed you guys with Detours, and like Clone Wars kind of, you know, through the shuffle, Clone Wars is getting canceled. Dark Horse is going to lose the comic book rights because they're going to go back to Marvel, keep it all under one umbrella. And then, like, like your show, it was like, looked like it was gung-ho, and all of a sudden, oh, we're going to kind of hold off on this. We're not canceling you, but did that kind of change your perspective on it at all? Were you like saying, wait a minute, I need this job right now. Come on, guys.
No, you know what? I mean, it didn't, you know, because I am also a fan. And I completely, I've told this story a few times, but not publicly, but, you know, My own children, are very ironically not really that interested in Star Wars. So I would show them, some of the clips that we were doing on Detours, and they would find them kind of funny, whatever. You know, my kids are young. But then in an effort to try and get them to ingrain in them how great Star Wars was, I would sort of like make them watch the movies. And after watching some of the Detours clips, when we watched episode 4, A New Hope, that moment, which is so poignant, when Darth Vader comes through the Tantive IV and walks into that hallway, he's supposed to be the scariest guy ever and in that universe. And my daughter pointed to him and laughed. She was like, oh, there's Darth Vader. And then she giggled, and I was like, and this was before any of this went down. I was like, no, you don't laugh at Darth Vader. You do not laugh at Darth Vader. Like, you don't understand. He's scary. He's a bad guy. Like, he has to have some weight. So when it came around to this decision, which makes complete sense, which was, you know, we can't induct a new audience to Star Wars with a parody of it, because Star Wars is not necessarily a goof. It's a serious drama, but it has family-friendly moments and comedic timing as well. But, you know, the idea that when they said, like, we don't want to make fun of something that we're trying to make a whole new enterprise out of, and as much as it pained me to see Detours end, I also said, I completely understand what you're saying. If no other reason than that very moment when my daughter laughed at Darth Vader, I totally got it. And as a fan, I was so dedicated to Detours, but the decision that they made to postpone it, or whatever is going to happen, I don't know. But at the time, I thought, as much as this hurts, as a fan, I'll sacrifice my own feelings for this, because I agree with what you're saying, and I want to see Star Wars be prolific and continue to be, you know, the amazing thing that it's been for almost 40 years, which is sort of a, you know, forget about the fact that it's sort of a, any sort of monetary enterprise. It's something that actually means something to people, and it's meant something to me my whole life. And I was very fortunate to get to do this show, and I want to make sure that it keeps on meaning the same thing to a whole new generation. And, you know, which is why I'm like, you know, I'm really, you know, I'm okay with the decision they made, and I'm also very supportive and happy to see the new show, Rebels, and, you know, on the forefront. And you know, Dave is a remarkable director and an amazing human. And I just think, like, you know, they just, I just hope to see the whole franchise continue to just be what it was when I was growing up, when we were all growing up, you know, because, you know, we all grew up with, you know, never knowing a world without Star Wars, you know.
So you still aren't, they still haven't told you anything as to what they want to do with the show, if they're actually going to let you complete it or put it on the air. They still haven't told you anything?
No, they haven't told me anything, and I suppose even if they have, I wouldn't be able to say.
Darn it.
But, you know, I mean, we've completed a lot of episodes. There are several episodes that are ready to be seen by people.
Like, but it's gonna seasons be worth, or like...
I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say, but like several, let's say lots.
Okay.
You know, more, you believe me, if you ever see it, you'll love it, and you'll be very happy with the amount of amount of content we have. But
I remember a lot of the teasers, and the panel from Celebration 6, and I understand what you're saying, and everyone too, that, you know, with the newer generation, you know, with the new films coming, which at the time we didn't know at C6.
Right.
But, you know, 3 months later hearing there is an episode 7 and, oh, by the way, I'm selling the company to Disney.
Right.
It makes sense when the announcement to put you guys on the back burner. It makes sense. Cause if not, I would be in the same boat as you. You know, my daughter's 4. Vader walks around. She wants to hide behind me at the moment.
Yeah.
But when we went to Star Wars Reads Day, this past September, and she goes up to Vader and goes, "Hi, Annie. How are you today?" And floored the guy inside the suit, like, "What'd you call me?"
I'm not Annie.
It's maybe it is, like you said, too soon for the new generation to have a parody come out with it.
Right.
And not understand the difference between the two.
You could argue that hasn't Seth Green and Seth MacFarlane, haven't they parodied it pretty good too? I mean, so it's out there already and people love those parodies that they did. So, you know, I would like to see more. I mean, one of the earliest bootlegs I can remember seeing was, Troopers from back in the day.
Yeah.
Back in the day when you only had the VHS tapes to copy to each other. And that was we were just fiending for more Star Wars material. So, I would love to see some more, but.
Yeah. Well, you know, the big difference I think with those things are, is that the Robot Chicken specials, which were brilliant, and the Family Guy specials, which, you know, also had their own sort of angle on it. Those were one-time things, and they came out like 5 years ago, you know, kind of a thing. So by the time, I mean, if you think about, you know, I myself was 3 years old when Star Wars came out in the movie theater, and that was the first movie I ever saw in the movie theater. And I don't remember it, of course, because I'm only 3, but I remember seeing Empire and Jedi and stuff like that. You know, if a Star Wars movie comes out in 2015, you might be looking at an audience of 5-year-old kids that were born in 2010. So, which was even before those, you know, they won't have a reference of those specials. Like, it's already, like, those things are already said and done, you know. Right. And there's always going to be ancillary media, you know, there's Lego stuff and things like that. But I think the bigger question was, like, are we going to put out a show that airs on a weekly basis, and that, you know, a lot of times once a show goes a whole season, it starts airing almost daily. It's the level of being in the public consciousness that will come into question. You know, if there's a one-time thing, like a Lego movie about Star Wars, that's one thing. Or if there's a Robot Chicken special from, you know, several years ago, those sort of things I don't think are as prevalent when it comes to the brand itself, and especially with young audiences. I would assume that a lot of like younger audiences probably would not be allowed to watch the Robot Chicken or Family Guy specials, you know. I think it's sort of, it's more of a global, you know, look at the broader picture, and those guys, you know, I know these guys. I know, you know, Howard Rothman and those guys, like they know what they're doing, and I think they're making the right decision, as much as it kills me to say. But I know what we made, and I know it's, you know, it may see the light of day someday. And I'm really proud of it. But you know, I think it's another, you know, another, I don't know what you'd call it, like another, facet of the Star Wars lore. And we never intended for anything to be like sort of, you know, necessarily true canon or anything like that. It was just, you know, it was something that George wanted to do. And you know, it may take 7, 6, 8 years, who knows? It may see the light of day someday, And when it does, I think people will be really, I think people will like it a lot.
As long as George doesn't stick it next to all those Christmas special episodes that he's apparently buying up and keeping people from wanting to ever see. So I think you're safe special. There.
Yeah,
you got to be more entertaining than that. So sight unseen, I can guarantee you that.
You know, it's funny enough, people love that holiday special as part of like Star Wars lore and history. It's sort of like an indelible mark.
it leaves a mark when you watch it. I hadn't seen it in many years, and a friend of mine got it, and we watched. We started to watch it. I don't think we actually made it all the way through before our wives made us just kind of turn it off and look at us like, what were we doing with our time?
Oh, it's so weird.
Yeah, it really is weird. It's crazy what they did.
I keep threatening to give the guys at the American Adventure or the American Gardens Theater at Epcot when Mickey Thomas comes in with Starship a loop of the Starship scene just to see what Mickey Thomas does.
I'll tell you what, we had the best experience where, you know, they have that entire special is very long. I mean, it was like a 2-hour thing.
Right.
It's very long. And they have the entire unedited version of it in the archives at the ranch.
Really?
And here's a little inside story for you. When we had one of our conferences with our writers, we got the Star Wars, the holiday special from the archives, and we watched it in the theater at the main house on the ranch, and we did it gong show style, and where if anyone couldn't take it anymore, they yelled gong, and we had to forward to the next bit. So instead of watching it in 2 hours, it lasted about 25 minutes.
Wow.
But it was great because we actually used, I mean, you know, I can't give anything away, but we glommed onto some of those elements that were in that holiday special. We wrote about it in our show. You know, we made it as if that holiday special was true Star Wars canon. And all the characters that are in it, Lumpy and the other Wookiees and stuff, we wrote them into the show. Maybe I'm saying too much. I should probably stop talking. But we'll make good on everything that is sort of like, you know, I mean, we make Jar Jar Binks beloved. And even before we did that, Matt Senreich and Seth Green did that in Robot Chicken. It's a really great story where Ahmed got an Annie Award for his voiceover work on Robot Chicken as Jar Jar Binks. And when he accepted the award, it was a really great moment because Jar Jar Binks was one of the, as far as Star Wars fans are concerned, a character that they just did not really much care for. So when that moment came along where he got that award, he felt sort of, you know, like finally, you know, I'm getting, you know, someone likes me. It was like the Sally Field, you like me, you really like me. You know, it was like a great moment for Ahmed because, you know, Ahmed is a really sweet guy. You know, he never meant any wrong to the Star Wars fans, you know. And you know, he was sort of, you know, his character was sort of, you know, became sort of the target of a lot of anti, you know, true Star Wars fandom, but you know when it came to the point where he was able to reap the rewards for making that character something that was more meaningful, which is comedy, you know, he actually was vindicated, and I think, you know, the world may never know, but hopefully they will. But what we did with Ahmed's character on Detours, you know, we made him a superstar. You know, we were hoping, you know, because he fit, like, his Jar Jar Binks was perfect for our, you know, for our, you know, what do you call it?
I don't
know
what you call it. Universe.
Yeah, exactly. He was a great character to work with.
That's actually a really interesting thought about Jar Jar, is the fact that he came into, like, this revered series and was trying to be the comedy bit and it didn't fit, but you put him in a show that's already trying to be a comedy bit and he's just another part of that cog, and suddenly, and, you know, maybe people will see a different side of Jar Jar that they never thought they'd actually enjoy.
Right. He brings sort of an endearing, you know, because like him or hate him, he's part of the Star Wars canon and he's part of the Star Wars universe. He exists in that realm because of what has already happened, and he's actually a great character if you sort of look at it from that perspective. And you know, yeah, I mean, I think what we were able to do with Jar Jar is like put him in an environment where he made sense, you know, he worked. But you know, it's a funny thing because George had said, in the early days of working on developing the show, we were like, well, let's take Jar Jar and make him a really funny character because he's already sort of a slapstick character. And George said, well, you know, when I made the original Star Wars series, all the older people hated C-3PO.
Yep.
And they were like, you know, the only people that liked C-3PO were kids. And when you look at the new films, the only people that like Jar Jar are kids. And so he was drawing no comparison, you know, no distinction between the two characters. They filled the role that they needed to fill, which was, you know, a really dramatic saga. And you have to have, like, if you look at Kurosawa films, you know, like Seven Samurai, you know, you've got these sort of characters that are the, I mean, I don't know if I want to say bumbling, but they're sort of like the silly characters. And Jar Jar, to what the modern audience is what C-3PO was to us. But I never hated it. I don't remember ever hating C-3PO, but maybe the teenage kids at the time did.
Well, the Ewoks always got the hate that I remember.
Right. It's like Barney with his, was it the Ewok line from How I Met Your Mother?
Exactly. Exactly. But yet again, the Ewoks, I mean, I don't know. I never had a problem with them.
Yeah, I never did either. That's why I always thought it was funny. People like bashing on the Ewoks but I think I was just at that right age where the Ewoks didn't look that deep into what the Ewoks were. They were just like, they're just another being on another planet to me.
Right.
So I accepted it.
Yeah.
When you look at it through adult eyes that are a lot more, you know, trying to connect all the dots together, then it can kind of throw off your view on it.
Yeah. But if you look at it in a way from like a classical storytelling standpoint, you know, George, I mean, he knew what he was doing. I mean, those elements are archetypal in classic storytelling. You know, there's always those types of characters. And, you know, they're part of the fabric that makes Star Wars what it is, you know?
Right.
I mean, no one looks back on Return of the Jedi and says, I think that's a terrible movie because there were Ewoks in it. You know, everybody loves that movie, and they love the Ewoks too, even though it was sort of a twist, you know?
Right.
You know, he took the same risk with Yoda in Empire Strikes Back, you know? Like, can I make a character a puppet? It's like, yeah, you can.
And people will believe that he's a real entity. You know, that's before CG, so, you know,
right.
what other choice do they have? You did a lot of puppets in Jedi that I think people thought kind of made it more kid-friendly, I guess, maybe harnessed the Star Wars that they knew.
Yeah, it was kid-friendly and also just, like, you know, good storytelling, you know, it was just like, it just made sense for what, you know, the Star Wars franchise is, which is like, you know, it never tries to say we're not, you know, Clone Wars is a very dramatic show and it, you know, it almost skirts the edge of being a little bit skewing a little bit older than any of the actual films ever did.
Right.
But, But barring that, I think the whole world of Star Wars has always been meant to be something that's for everyone, and particularly young people, you know?
Yeah.
Now, are you able to say what network Detours would have appeared on? Or were y'all that far yet?
I might be able to say if I knew. I mean, you know, who knows? I mean, there was never, you know, there was never anything solid in terms of like a moving forward deal with any other network. It was too premature at the time of the Disney sale. And once that happened, it was a foregone understanding that, yeah, it was, you know, I mean, once Disney bought the property, it's not like the show was going to be on Nickelodeon or Cartoon Network at that point. But leading up to that, there was never any, you know, anything in the works with any other network, basically. So, you know.
Now, I also saw you were supposed to voice Bib Fortuna.
Oh, you know, I did, yeah. I did voice him.
Can you give us a little?
Since he's got,
I don't remember him in any of the teaser stuff.
Oh, really? No. You remember Karma Chameleon? We did a little bit of Karma Chameleon. No, yeah. He's kind of like hey, the mighty Yabba want to know, do you or do you not fart in here? You know, like, he's just like, down here in there. You know, that kind of thing.
Awesome.
Took a script from, we had so many like ideas on what that character would be. I was surprised that those guys let me actually be that character. Because, you know, it was just, you know, I really wanted to like, when we were originally designing the show, we were all talking about all these scenarios and everything, and we used to say all of the scenes in the characters' voices, and I was very much like, I was, oh yeah, and then Bib comes in, he goes, I don't think this is, you know, like, it was just like, I think the only reason I got cast was people just got used to hearing me say it, you know?
And you probably work for scale, too, so. That's
no, and you, everybody works for scale on Star Wars.
Now the speaking of cast list voice work, the one that's compiled on IMDb that you guys have been able to accrue is quite the who's who of nerddom in a lot of ways. You got Zachary Levi and yeah. Seth Green, Seth MacFarlane, Anthony Daniels, Felicia Day, got Billy Dee, Donald Faison and Breckin Meyer. I mean, those are names that everybody knows and kind of already in that realm of loving Star Wars just from like the Robot Chicken stuff.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because a lot of the you know, we found that, and it wasn't surprising at all, but we found that a lot of talented people were interested in working on Star Wars because they're actual fans in and of themselves, and you know, people wanted to do the show. You know, they wanted to be a part of it. No one was ever thinking to themselves, oh, I'm going to do the show and it's going to be like, you know, some sort of big hit. Everybody that did any role on the show was always, you know, they were all fans. And if you look at, like, even the list you just read of people, it's a lot of people that are, like, heavily involved in the geekdom community, you know, like Felicia. You know, these people are all fans of Star Wars. Donald Faison, who was a big character on our show, he is the biggest Star Wars fan. You know, he almost surpasses me. I mean, he doesn't quite, but he's close. Close to me.
He does have one of the great moments from Scrubs where he gets introduced to Billy Dee Williams and he keeps calling him Lando all the time. which you can't really tell if like that was maybe just an inside joke that they brought to the screen or not, but he plays it so well.
It's really great, yeah, and Billy's like, I'm Billy, and he's like, no. Yeah, no, those are some great moments. And like, yeah, no, I mean, it's just, I think that might be a little bit of a, the luxury of working on a property like Star Wars. You know, it's like everybody knows what it is. When you approach people about other projects that are like unknown, you get a lot of maybes. But people knew what this was, and they knew Seth and Matt Senreich, and they had, you know, they knew that they were making something that was going to be special, because those guys are, you know, they had already done a lot of, you know, those guys are really talented, and they have already done a lot of stuff and worked with a lot of those actors. And we were very fortunate to be able to say, this is Star Wars, and it's also working with friends that you know. Really, really super talented people that you can trust are going to make something funny with what your performance. Because a lot of actors, they can give a great performance, but if you don't put forth the, you know, like good storytelling and funny, and a funny episode with their performance, you know, it doesn't mean as much. But if they know that you're going to take their performance and make it really work with the show, then they're much more, you know, they're much more interested in working with you. And we were fortunate to have not only Star Wars, but the Robot Chicken guys, Matt and Seth, who a lot of these guys have worked with in the past, and those actors were comfortable with their skills and their abilities. So we were very lucky.
Super ace and killer. Was that Tag and Bink?
No. No, it was more like Bill Murray. Like, do you ever see Stripes?
Yes.
It's more like that kind of guy. Like, Bill Murray. Like, we were looking at, you know, Donald Faison had already done a character named Gary on Robot Chicken. It was a stormtrooper and his wife was nagging him. Oh, yeah. About like take your daughter to work. It's so funny, and I'm telling you, this was one of the things that George himself loved. He actually, when I met George, he brought this up. He said that take your daughter to work thing is really funny, and the thing that he liked the most about, and that was Donald who did the voice of that stormtrooper, but. You know, not to derail that, but as a sideline, George said, you know, that's what I love about Matt and Seth, was that they don't take Star Wars and make fun of it. They don't take the logic of Star Wars and say that's stupid and make fun of it. They take the Star Wars universe and mine humor from the irony of it. So he's like, could you imagine take your daughter to work day with a stormtrooper? It was like, he thought that was genius, and I agree with him, and frankly, it is genius, you know? And that was Donald. And so when it came to saying, like, who are we going to have face, you know, killer, it was like, yeah, Donald's perfect. He's already done it as Gary on Robot Chicken, you know? I mean, we auditioned several people. But, I mean, there was no question, you know. I mean, it was just his indelible voice and comedy and humor fit that role perfectly. And it was just, you know, another one of those moments that it was just like, this is perfect.
Oh, I can't believe I didn't think to ask you about this before, but your first meeting with George Lucas, how did that go for you? Did you have to restrain yourself from being uber fanboy? Or do you have that moment where, you know, you remember exactly what you wore that day, what you ate for breakfast? I mean, what was the process going through your head when you got to meet George and talk to him for the first time?
Yeah, no, I think, you know, I was trying to play it cool. I was trying to be really cool. I mean, guys, like, I mean, I don't know if, like, you can challenge me on this, at least for the first three films. I've watched those films so many times, I know every single line in those movies. I mean, like, Star Wars was a part of my life forever. So meeting George was like, you know, something I never thought would happen to me, but I tried to play it cool. And at that point I felt like I had done enough, like I had been around enough, like, people like George at that point. Like, you know, I had met Steven Spielberg and other people like that. Like I was like, okay, I know what to do here, because I know these guys, like, they don't want to be, you know, like, I wasn't going to fanboy George for sure, because, you know, that's just not what you want to do on the first meeting. So I tried to play it cool, but in my mind I was thinking, like, OMG, that's G-dub, you know? Like, but I remember my producer, Jennifer Hill, she was like, dude, you were kind of rocking in your chair a little bit too much. Like, where I thought you might blow it. And I was like, what? Was I really? I thought I was being super cool. She's like, no, you were twitching a little bit. But in my recollection, I was being, like, super cool. But she, you know, she recalls it a little differently. But, right. But yeah, I remember a lot of people saying to me, like, are you ready for this? And I was like, no, I'm totally fine. It's cool. But then when I got in the room with George, we started talking about just the filmmaking process, and he was telling me about his ideas on how, you know, there's no distinction between animation and film and television and film. It's just the way you shoot it and the way you approach it and the way you tell an appropriate story. And that really was something that I had been already thinking about. So I was like, yeah, this guy, yeah, you know, it suddenly became, instead of being sitting in a room with George Lucas, it was more like sitting in a room with a guy that knows a lot of stuff about filmmaking and just listening to him talk. He didn't ask me a single question. All he did was talk about how he likes to make movies and television shows. And I was like, wow, the guy did not even ask me anything. He didn't ask me a single question. So that was kind of interesting.
I think if I ever had the chance, I think for some reason I just want to touch the beard. I don't know if they have people to keep you from doing that, but something about the beard just makes me want to reach up there and touch it. I don't know.
Well, I touched his beard.
Did you?
Yeah. You know, like, over the course of working on the show, I was able to ask George every question I ever wanted to know about Star Wars. I was like, what's that black blurb on the Emperor's head in Jedi, you know, like, you know, when he's got the robe, I don't know, they kind of tried to fix it in the special edition, but there was always that, like, weird, there's like a weird black blob on the side of his head.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, what was that big bright white light at the end of the detention corridor? You know, like, I asked him everything I ever wanted to know, and he had all the answers for me.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah.
Like,
what
a guy on the plane.
What was that?
I was just saying, I feel like the luckiest guy on Earth, basically.
Yeah, and he wasn't tired of answering. That's the amazing thing, too. He's been probably answering these questions for 30 years, and he has no problem answering them yet again to somebody.
Ironically, I don't think he was ever asked those questions. I think maybe once or twice, because I think most people don't get
past the meat and bones.
Right. I think most people are just like, hey, you know, like, I was genuinely interested in his filmmaking process, and I asked him a lot of questions about how they shot THX and stuff like that, too. Like, how did you make that white room? Like, the infinite white room.
Right.
You know, and George loves the process, so he was very, you know, open to just talking about it. So it was a really fortunate time in my life to be able to, you know, hear directly from the horse's mouth the answers to these questions.
So what's current or what's in the future of Todd Grimes?
I mean, who knows? Can you give me a job? I mean, I don't know.
It won't be the same pay. It's what you got out there with Disney.
We can make this a trio. Come on, we got this. What are you doing every Wednesday night?
Yeah, exactly. I'll come back every night. This is a lot of fun. I'll run out of things to talk about, but I mean,
oh, I'll just add you to the show notes.
I can talk about a lot of other films and stuff, but for me personally, we're, you know, I've been working with my writing partner and I have been developing a lot of shows, and we're working with a lot of people, including the Super Buddy guys and some people, you know, at various networks down south. We're basically trying to, be prolific and try and create more new content. But for now, you know, it's kind of like I've really been, since the end of Detours, I've been working so hard for so long. And when the end of Detours came, I really sort of have been enjoying just kind of being a dad, being a real dad, you know. like, I actually take my kids to school, and I pick them up from school once in a while, you know. And, like, I'm home before they go to bed, you know. So I've been able, fortunately for me, I've been able to sort of work on development and also be like part of my own family for once. But hopefully there will be some new things coming soon, but none of which are really anything we could talk about yet, but I'm very optimistic about, you know, what's going to happen. So.
Very cool.
Yeah.
You got anything else for
it? I was going to say, you're on Twitter, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
What's your Twitter handle?
It's I'm Todd Grimes, like the letter I M, Todd Grimes.
And I was gonna say I was kind of perusing your Twitter account earlier today, and just happened to notice a very interesting thing you linked on there. It was you taking the Star Wars personality quiz.
Oh yeah.
And
I got Princess Leia.
Yeah, you got Princess Leia, and I was like, was that your intention? Did you, you know, was that what you were crossing your fingers for, getting Princess Leia? How did that happen?
I thought for sure I'd be Han Solo. I mean,
everybody wants to be Han Solo, but you get Princess Leia and you kind of like, maybe you take it back and like, maybe I'm not as hardcore as I thought.
No, well, actually, you know what? I would dispute that, because I actually think that Princess Leia is actually the most hardcore character in all of Star Wars. She is the most headstrong and biggest badass in all of Star Wars.
She did watch an entire planet that she used to live on die in front of her eyes and not shed a tear.
Yep.
So.
Well, she's got the highest shot accuracy, too, in all the films.
Yeah, she'll kill the most stormtroopers.
So, okay, all right, I'll let you have the congrats of having Princess Leia.
Exactly. Princess Leia, aside from the fact that she's female and I'm not, she is a strong leader, and she sets a goal, and she is steadfast in, you know, making sure that goal comes true, and she ultimately wins in the end. So I'm okay with being Princess Leia.
Just don't start doing any Instagrams of you in the slave lay gear, and we'll be okay.
Well, I mean, I have some photos of me in that outfit, but those are never going to see the light of Instagram. And I'm kidding.
I think that almost wraps it up for this week.
Yeah.
Thank you, Ty, for coming on.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you for shedding some light. Hopefully we're the first group to get this information about some of the backstory on Detours.
Yeah.
So thank you for coming on and sharing the light about that. And Marty, where can they find you on Twitter?
I am at Giant Yoda on Twitter.
And I am at WeebieGeeks on Twitter. And you know, we've gone far enough this week. Anything else you need to know about us? You know, where to find, call us or email us. I'll put it in the show notes when this goes up. But until next time, we'll just wait for those magic words.
Give the evacuation code signal.
I will bring you back a snowball.
All right, cut the chatter. spaceship will self-destruct in 1 second. This is your last chance to push the cancellation button.
It's over, Prime.
Adventure. Excitement.
Why didn't I pick the blue pill?
I wouldn't trust this overgrown pile of microchips any further than I could throw it.
Hold it. I said hold it.
By the way, why are we wearing bras on our heads?
What's our motive?
Clark, I don't like the look of this neighborhood.
Come on, Ellen. It's important for the kids to witness the flight of the rebellion. Kids, you noticing all this flight? Roll them up.
We Be Geeks, your voice of the geek revolution.
This has been a We Be Geeks production.